From the late 1940s to the late 80s, a large mural hung inside the offices of the New York Times. It greeted staff members and guests with the first two lines of the poem New Every Morning by the 19th century American writer Sarah Chauncey Woolsey. The mural was commissioned directly by Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger Sr. and created by an artist named Eugene Kingman. The lines from New Every Morning were added at Sulzberger's request, and here's an excerpt from that poem, including those first two lines.
Every day is a fresh beginning. Every morn is the world made new. You who are weary of sorrow and sinning, here is a beautiful hope for you, a hope for me and a hope for you. All the past things are past and over, the tasks are done and the tears are shed. Yesterday's errors let yesterday cover, yesterday's wounds which smarted and bled, are healed with the healing which night has shed. Every day is a fresh beginning. Listen, my soul, to the glad refrain. In spite of old sorrow and older sinning, and puzzles forecast and impossible pain, take heart with the day and begin again.
There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Later this year, Philbrook will celebrate 80 years as a museum. We thought it might be fun to look back, way back, to the very beginning and get to know the museum's first director, Eugene Kingman. Mark Brown does many things at the museum, including serving as our kind of de facto in-house editor. Before coming to the museum, he worked as a newspaper editor for nearly 20 years. He recently wrote a profile piece on Eugene Kingman called Of Murals and Mesas, and we sat down to talk about it. All right, so I'm going to lay this on you first.
Okay.
Here's the headline. This is from June 11th, 1939. So the museum is founded in 38, 39, things are in motion. They've hired a guy. And the headline in the Tulsa World reads this, New Englander chosen Philbrook Museum head. Now, I guess they couldn't squeeze the word as in there because there just wasn't enough space. But
classic headline.
But what are they trying to get across with that? Is that something like a shot across the bow? Like, is that a... Can you believe this? Or why are they describing him as a New Englander?
Well, anything that came from New York back in that day, preferably from Paris, but if it came from New York, it had a kind of credential that it didn't have if it came from here.
So Eugene Kingman, one, great name. I think it's a really good name.
Yeah.
He's 30 years old when he starts as director of Philbrook. He starts in 1939. This guy is coming from the Rhode Island School of Design. He was an instructor of mural painting at what is commonly known as RISD, or the Rhode Island School of Design. This is in Providence.
Right.
Before that, he had been at Yale. He studied art at Yale. So he's very much a kind of blue blood in that classic sense. He's got blonde hair and all this stuff. He comes to Philbrook. What do you think this guy thought of this place? Because it was brand new. It had been a house for the last 11, 12 years, and now it's going to become a museum all of a sudden?
Yeah, I think the thing that from my reading, which was not exhaustive, but the file was thin on the guy. But what I found was there was so much anticipation around building a collection, not coming into one. And I think he really thought that he had an opportunity to jump in on the ground floor, so to speak, and shape things and become the creator of that first impression that Philbrook would become.
Do you think this guy had any aspirations as to be a museum director? I mean, he was basically an artist who then entered academia because of obvious reasons, probably to pay the bills and whatnot. But he was a successful artist, and he probably found himself in this position of, you know, leading a museum or even starting a museum, which is probably more specific. What was his background like as far as where was he coming from at this point?
Well, you've said it. I mean, his East Coast experience would not have lent itself to this necessarily. But you got to remember that in a lot of ways, the length between New York and Tulsa was not that great back then with regard to the idea that we had a lot of oil guys with, you know, connections in New York, offices in New York, and there was always this dialogue going back and forth. The question is this, though. I think that, like any artist, the guy probably had a very reluctant acceptance of a position that was really not going to be much about creation anymore. It was going to be about facilitating creation and curating and archiving and et cetera. So I like to think that in like all classic artistic cases, he had a kind of compromise ahead of him, that he saw probably the end of one career. He alludes to that in some of his writings later about not having enough time to paint. I think he knew that something was coming to a close, but it was an opportunity now with a new wife that he couldn't afford to not take.
So practicality comes into play
sure.
at some point.
Yeah.
So it's not unlike our current director, Scott Stuhlen, who came from studio art background, practicing artist, and has now found himself as director of a museum.
It's almost eerily like that. Yeah.
Pretty young, for the not as young as Eugene Kingman was,
right.
but in the museum world, considered a very young director, came from that background. It's interesting because when you look at museum directors in general, a lot of people come from the education tract. A lot of people come from past curators, but you don't see a lot who really did come from being a practicing working artist. Seeing these two parallels, 80 years separated. Is kind of interesting. It's kind of one of the reasons I think we wanted to pursue some of these ideas in the first place.
Yeah, I think so. When you sort of assigned this kind of thing in a weird way, it made sense from one perspective because I didn't know a lot about Eugene Kingman. I didn't even know his name. And so the natural journalist in me wanted to go climbing and see what we could find out. But yeah, when we saw how it was going to bookend this whole line of directors, of which there are some dozen or so, maybe not quite that many, in the history of Philbrook, it was a pretty amazing kind of closure.
When you're presented with something, I think there's two different kinds of people. There's people that when you hear about something you've never heard about before, you're kind of like, yeah, I've lived long enough without it. I don't need to add that to my mental Rolodex. And then there's another kind of person that says, yeah, but what else is there? I want to know more. Have you always been kind of curious in that way?
I don't know if always fits that. I didn't come by journalism through the usual route. So I'd hesitate to say that I was born into it. But that's one thing about the discipline is that the more you practice it, the more that instinct becomes something you want to hone.
Is that because you know that for almost everything, there's usually more there
yeah.
than what's presented
yes.
at the surface level?
And I've never been a hard news guy. I suspect that with hard news investigative people, that's even more a tenacious kind of thread. With me, though, it's always just kind of, I'm just curious about that next reveal and what it does for me.
So a couple of years before Kingman starts working as a director, before he's announced as a director, he's a practicing artist. He does a major spread for the March 1937 issue of National Geographic.
Correct.
And it's in some ways very traditional in the sense that it's landscapes, which is what you would expect to see in National Geographic.
Right.
But these weren't your everyday landscapes. These were almost dreamlike in a certain sense. What was he trying to depict in these?
Well, they assigned him, the subject matter was Crater Lake and Yosemite, two separate parks, some 500 miles apart out there in California. And they basically tried to get him to depict a time before history, a time prehistoric in nature where, put us in a place that we can never be. And why they settled on Kingman, I think, is a kind of interesting mystery. Of course, yeah, he had a mural teaching background. But the thing that's really fascinating about the approach is that you could see in that National Geographic and some of the headlines and some of the subjects in that particular issue that they were transitioning to a more photographic approach and a more color photographic approach. And so the illustrations kind of sort of ring out as a throwback in a way.
I mean, there's 13 paintings he did for this spread.
Right,
which
it's huge.
I mean, I wonder what lead time he had on something like this. I mean, the publishing world always does have long leads, but to assign someone 13 paintings, it seems like you need to give somebody like a year or something to work on that.
Yeah, and I don't know how long he had. There's no story behind the story on that, but they're not the most I wouldn't call them simplistic, but imagine a landscape painter being given the opportunity, or a mural painter given the opportunity to sort of depict a prehistory, and imagine what that might look like.
I mean, it reminded me of that scene in Fantasia, you know, with right. the dinosaurs, and yeah. kind of, and also like, you know, the beginning of 2001 or something, like these kind of ideas that are based mostly on reading things rather than, obviously, you could never see that. You mentioned that the National Geographic was moving more into photographs. The headline on that issue was "First Color Photograph from the Stratosphere." That was what they were really pitching as the hot, sexy thing in this issue.
Right.
So
right.
to have that balanced with these 13 right. paintings of what the prehistoric, you know, national parks would
right,
look like.
Right. And why national parks? Crater Lake, I understand, obviously, because it's kind of a geographic anomaly in some ways, but. Clearly, National Geographic was doing photography, but you could feel the tide turning with the color reproduction and just the ability to realize that they were definitely turning a corner away from a time when they would even think about illustrating with a graphic like that. And so it's interesting that Kingman came in to do a huge spread on such a strange topic.
So before that, about 6 or 7 years before that, he had gotten commissioned by the National Park Service
right.
to do a series of 7 murals for the National Park Service, 7 murals about America.
Right.
And these were displayed in Paris in 1931 at the Colonial Exposition,
correct.
Which was a 6-month-long show. So, you know, obviously he'd had, even years before the National Geographic piece, he had been in this world. It's an interesting idea to kind of fall into this. You know, you think about people like Diego Rivera and people that are kind of really tied, but there aren't a lot of big names that you can kind of associate with the concept of mural artists.
Right.
But that was kind of his area, his niche
yeah.
in the world.
And I didn't find any material on this, but I would be really curious to know why that media was chosen to represent the U.S. in that exposition. It just seems like an odd way to put your foot forward in 1931. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean the whole, and we have copies of this issue in our archives. You were able to look through some of these materials and see them for yourself. I believe we have some actual art of his as well in our collection. You know, some actual paintings.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that he moved to Tulsa with his wife Elizabeth,
right?
And they hadn't been married for very long at this point. And these are two, you know, very cosmopolitan couple coming to Tulsa. You know, moving to the middle of America. And I wanted to read this great piece just to think about how the times have changed. A journalist writing for the Tulsa World, the Sunday edition, who had this great name, Malvina Stevenson,
right,
was basically probably writing, you know, a society column or some kind of column.
Right.
She describes him as a, quote, big husky fellow and a veteran of frequent treks in the American West. Easy to know and easy to like, young, blonde, you know, really describing him. When they describe his wife, Elizabeth, who, let's not forget, was one of the first women to ever get a master's degree from the University of Denver.
Correct.
She was studied anthropology, very, very smart, accomplished woman in her own right. This is what the Tulsa World at that time wrote about her. His wife is almost as tall and almost as blonde, and the green of her smartly tailored dress was reflected in her eyes, and she uses her hands to emphasize her statements and looks to her husband for acceptance of what she is saying.
There's so much going on in that. And of course it's really dangerous to get this far ahead of something and look back and talk about the way that writing styles came together back then. But the thing that I think is the interesting takeaway is you can feel them trying to be reverent and creative at the same time. There was another story that came either the day before or the day after, and it has that same descriptive effort toward their size. And I think it's interesting. You could almost think, given the assignment of doing a society page, they were just trying like crazy to add some element of literary quality to it to get it to jump off the
page.
You
think that's just purple prose? That's just splash, just trying to have
completely.
Some fun with it.
Of course.
And those kind of society gossip columns, whatever, you those pages lend themselves to some of that too. So,
especially back then.
Yeah. You got to think though, for a woman like Elizabeth Kingman, whose maiden name was Yelm, Y-E-L-M,
right.
Reading something like that, knowing what she had done and her accomplishments, she probably was thinking, you know, this is what I'm being reduced to. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Obviously, we'll never know. You had a chance to actually correspond with his daughter,
right.
Who is still living
right.
and was able to provide some materials to us. And her name was Maxine Kingman. Her new last name is Eddy, E-D-D-Y.
Right.
How did you get in touch with her?
I found her on the website.
So there is a EugeneKingman.com website,
right?
For those who'd like to know.
Yeah, she curates it. She's basically been the guardian of the legacy. She has sisters and I think a brother, and she's just taken on the role.
Yeah.
But it's fun because there's just not a lot out there on the guy. And so to find an actual website that has images and a history that's not incomplete, I mean, it's a decent history.
Well, it's got some great stuff on there about this mural he did for the New York Times.
Right.
This would have been about 10 years after being at Philbrook, and it stayed in there for 40 years, this giant mural he did that guests could see as they came in.
Right, right.
And then it was kind of lost for a while and then rediscovered and had to be restored, ended up back in Omaha. But before we kind of get into all that, that next step, there's an in-between thing that we're not talking about, which is kind of the most interesting part to me about his journey here. He comes to Philbrook in 39. Well, of course, the world in 1939 is basically already at war. The United States is not partaking yet. And then a couple of years later, Pearl Harbor happens. And he up and leaves Philbrook. He decides, hey, peace out. I'm out of here. I'm going to go serve my country. And what does a person like Eugene Kingman go and do during World War II?
Well, there's a perfect place for him. And I don't know if he knew that, but somebody knew it. And that's where he ended up. And it was called the Office of Strategic Services. It's the precursor to the CIA.
The OSS.
Right. And it's tailor-made for him because they're in need of strategic cartography. And he's
map making.
He's a map maker. He's just been, this is sort of a dream come true for him.
They're probably thinking, we got this guy who's just an amazing person.
Right. I've often thought about what did they put him on? What were his assignments?
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of things were they drawing?
Yeah, are there any remnants probably of that?
There have to be. Yeah, but like, you know, imagine finding those. There's probably some office somewhere.
You probably don't sign them, of course.
Yeah. Or maybe they were just destroyed. Who knows?
Burn box kind of thing. Yeah, that's interesting.
But, you know, I thought about the Philbrook, the Southwestern Art Association board that brought this guy in.
And the Southwestern Art Association, just to back up, is the organization that was a private entity that was created to transition from a private residence. Wade Phillips then donated the house to the Southwestern Art Association.
Correct.
And then they basically had the task of turning it into a functioning museum and hiring the director.
And hiring a first director. And I don't know if they knew that they weren't going to have a guy for very long. They knew they were obviously hiring a draftable age person. And here we are on the cusp of World War II. So I had to think that in the back of their minds, they thought, well, he's perfect, but we may not have him for long.
Yeah.
I think
when you look back at history, people had a pretty big sense that at some point we were going to be embroiled in this conflict.
Right, right. He ended up giving us 2 years, I think.
Because he never came back.
No, he never came back. I think, he jumped around, but he ultimately ended up at what became the Texas Tech Museum
in Lubbock.
But he had a 22-year stint at the Joslin in Omaha. So he wasn't a fly-by-night guy. He didn't leave.
Yeah, I mean, he went back to museum directing.
Right.
And did that for
no
the
journeyman.
Rest of his career.
Yeah.
And you've talked about there's, writings about what, did he have time to devote to his work? Was he able to really, fulfill his needs as a working artist? And of course, conflict comes in when you're doing those two things. And I don't think it's as simple as the kind of thing we say about teachers, if you can't do something, you teach. It's not that.
I think
you had to make a living and different things. So it's very obvious when you look at his work and who he was that he was really fascinated by the West, this big idea, romantic concept of the West. And a lot of times these guys from New England that grew up in this very different kind of world, they view that as something very different.
Sure.
And who knows, maybe he thought coming to Oklahoma was going to be more West than it actually ended up being, because we're kind of not right there yet. But, things like Mesa Verde and other places played a big role in his life. You actually went out there.
Yep.
To that spot.
Right.
Right around the time of writing this piece.
Right.
Was that kind of, do you think that enhanced your experience having thought about it some before?
Oh, absolutely. I didn't even realize that these planets were aligning. I had worked on, was beginning to assemble notes and make and paragraphs for what would become this piece. And then I realized that I was going out to Durango, and I started looking around on a Google map, And it's right there. Mesa Verde is 30 minutes away or something. And when you're thinking about travel plans and how you're going to, space out your trip and all these things, it just never even occurred to me. I was thinking about it more from a logistical standpoint. And then I thought, oh my gosh, this is where Elizabeth Yelm met Eugene Kingman.
You're the only person in the world who would even think that, of course.
And before this assignment, it wouldn't have mattered. And so that was a very strange opportunity.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Museum Gift Shops. You've seen the exhibit, you've roamed the galleries, you've enjoyed and/or puzzled over the art, you've grown as a person, you've pondered the big questions, and you feel at this point like you've walked a country mile. Or two. Uphill. But please don't forget on your way out, dear patron, to visit the Museum Gift Shop. Postcards and prints? Yep. Books and bookmarks? We have those. T-shirts and coffee mugs, indeed. Oven mitts, magnets, shoelaces, pencil sharpeners, gizmos, tchotchkes, and tons of swag. Yes, yes, all around. And some of it might even be marked down a bit. Spend a little, spend a lot, do your part, join the club. This is capitalism you can trust, people. This is consumerism we art lovers can believe in. This is merch for a cause. Visit the museum gift shop. Complete the transaction. Memorialize this moment. And never mind the fact that gift is the German word for poison.
When you have time, not that this was like a year-long project, but you spent time thinking about this, researching it, looking up things. We have some great resources in our archives, in our library.
Right.
When you write about people that, of course, you've never met, you never heard of before, do you feel like you're communicating with them at any kind of point? Do you feel some kind of connection to them when you're standing out there looking over this amazing vista in a place like that? Is there some kind of connection beyond just the words that's happening?
Yeah, you think about how you're trying to do, I don't want to call it, you're not trying to honor them. That's not the thing. But you, in an attempt to be authentic and as truthful as you can and as revealing as you can with as little data as you might have, you want to sort of find a way to see the way they see.
Do you think it's in some way tied to this kind of ultimate act of empathy?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Trying to understand
people
that don't exist anymore.
And it would be, like, the way I thought of it was when I got up to the top of Mesa Verde, there's a couple of really great vistas, and I was able to look out across what is essentially the Four Corners area of the United States. You actually acknowledge to yourself, this is a view he would have seen. And so immediately I can start to describe it in a way that I feel like he would have seen it. And so all of a sudden he does become mine for that brief little moment that I have the opportunity to be with him.
When he came on board Philbrook, he had this great thing that he said that I think resonates with the way, we think of the way museums are changing now and the way we think about museums more as these community gathering places. And they're not just stuffy institutions with stuff on the wall that you have to be quiet in all the time.
Right.
But he said, it won't be a museum. He's describing Philbrook and what his vision of it is. And he says, it won't be a museum. It'll be a place to come and stay and return to again and again. So it speaks to this idea that even to him, museums maybe, even in 1939, were kind of like, that doesn't sound interesting or fun to me. I want it to be something else. I want it to be a place that benefits repeat visits and is something more than the sum of its parts.
Right. He could have made a great director today. He already saw that opportunity for public engagement that is such a catchphrase now in the museum world. And I think a lot of it probably had to do with the fact that it wasn't known for its collection at the time. It didn't really have much of a collection. And he was going to be on the ground floor of building it. And so he had a say in that. And it had to be a great opportunity to think about, how do you get an audience and how do you keep them? And what does that look like for however long he may have thought? I don't think he thought it was going to be a 2-year stint, but either way, it had to be a great time to build up from the ground floor.
Well, thanks for writing the piece. We enjoyed it.
It was fun.
Mm-hmm. Mark Brown is the executive assistant to the director at Philbrook Museum of Art. His profile of Eugene Kingman, the first director of Philbrook, appeared in that museum's newsletter in 2016. And because, as we just heard, Mr. Kingman was such an ardent fan of the American West, we offer the following postscript by Mark Brown about his own trips out there.
My own family started going west 5 years ago. We'd always talked about finding a place we could return to every summer, a memory-making destination that we could paste in our family album. We started looking around. I thought about up in Michigan, on the peninsula. My wife suggested somewhere in Maine, but we were getting nowhere. Then my in-laws suggested we join them in the little burg of Nathrop, Colorado, at a tidy campground called Chalk Creek, where they'd been taking their RV for several summers. They even gave us a tent for Christmas and one of those Coleman cook stoves. We hadn't been to Colorado in 20 years when we went to Denver for a friend's wedding. Our kids had never been. So we drove west through Dodge City, camping overnight at a KOA in La Junta, an old trading post on the Santa Fe Trail. The Arkansas River flows north of town, winding its way to the John Martin Reservoir, after which it all but evaporates until climbing north at Great Bend, Kansas, where gravity revives it for the long march south. West of La Junta, at Rocky Ford, you begin to make out mountain shapes on the horizon, the Sierra Mojada, and beyond them, the Sangre de Cristo. 2 hours later, at Canyon City, the Arkansas runs fast and clear over old stones, and the majestic collegiate peaks will often show snow, even in August. Staring into a campfire, I let the ripple of Chalk Creek lull me into a false sense of security. Soon enough, I will leave this bubbling tributary to our own silty brown Arkansas and be forced yet again to only dream of mountains and percolating trout streams from the plains of my prairie home. Wallace Stegner, the novelist and historian often called the Dean of Western Writers, had this to say about going west. And for that matter, just going.
It should not be denied that being footloose has always exhilarated us. It is associated in our minds with escape from history and oppression and law and irksome obligations, with absolute freedom, and the road has always led west.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
Let's go!